This week on Behind the Lens. What was behind local educators' failed attempt to re-up the contract of Dr. Henderson Lewis? The Convention Center announces grants for hospitality workers. Will they be enough to satisfy calls for more support for laborers? We'll look at the struggle to implement contact tracing to curb the spread of COVID-19. Also, legal advocates demand the release of immigrant detainees and jazz festing in place. We'll talk with WWOC's general manager about a massive online project to give the world a little taste of the city's favorite festival, despite the stay-home orders. I'm Tom Wright. You're listening to Behind the Lens, brought to you by community support. Learn more at thelensnoaa.org/donate. We welcome our listeners on our partner radio stations, 102.3 FM WHIV LP and 90.3 FM WAMF LP, New Orleans. With stay-home orders in place across the state, from city politics to the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, more and more of our lives, our work, and our community activity depend on digital bandwidth. And it was a controversial move by the Orleans Public School Board that brought a lot of parents online this week. Board members backed off a surprise proposal to extend Superintendent Henderson Lewis's contract. Marta Jusen monitored the online meeting.
So it was really, for me anyways, a slowly developing situation over the day. We saw that there was an amendment to the superintendent's contract on the board agenda, but there were no details about it. So we didn't know anything until they got out of a one-hour executive session, and they kind of slowly asked each other about it, and it turned out they wanted to offer him a one-year contract extension, at which point the public wanted to weigh in a little bit more, and then they ended up retracting that offer after some heavy criticism.
And my understanding is Dr. Lewis's contract is not up until summer of next year?
Correct. This would have been very early for a normal timetable.
What reason was offered for this move at this particular time?
So I spoke to board member Woody Koppel before the meeting, and he said he would support such a move just because, you know, we don't really know how long this COVID-19 pandemic is going to last, and that with a new board coming in January after fall elections, like maybe they would like that stability. But on the flip side, a lot of the criticism they got yesterday was that with more than a year to go in his contract, this would be a pretty premature move to make, especially amid a crisis when it's hard for the public to have access to these meetings. This was a virtual board meeting.
A digital conference call of sorts. And you were certainly witness to some of the technical difficulties that the board had in managing this call.
Yeah, so there were small difficulties at the beginning, you know, just people forgetting to unmute their mics and stuff, which is not necessarily the biggest deal, but it is a pretty big deal if a board member is voting on something. Just small things like that, and ensuring that people, you know, the secretary would be able to even accurately record their actions. And then there were different points in time where it was unclear if everyone could hear the call. And then the biggest issue was coming out of executive session. It took about 10 minutes to get one of the board members back online. And then even when they were back online, they couldn't tell if other people could hear them. It was just kind of a messy situation.
Sort of. Sure.
And then the public was asking via a chat function to be able to comment. And normally the board closes comments 30 minutes after a meeting starts, but the public really didn't know details of this move until much later in the meeting.
Of course, one of the members of the public that you report on is no stranger to the board. Talk to me about Patrick Dobard's comments.
Sure. Patrick Dobard is a known leader in the education community. He's a former superintendent of the Recovery School District and the current CEO of New Schools for New Orleans. He came in and he said that he would really hope the board would hold off on this move, that, you know, knowing that one of their concentrations right now is getting Wi-Fi to families, that means they very well know that families don't necessarily have access to these meetings, and also that it just wasn't the proper time to be making a move like this.
As far as Dr. Lewis is concerned, Dr. Lewis for now continues in his role as superintendent. There was certainly praise from what I read at the meeting for his work during the pandemic. Was there any indication that other school districts might be shopping for someone like Dr. Lewis?
I hadn't heard anything to that effect, although one commenter did mention that, and whether, you know, if that was the concern of the board, that, you know, there are plenty of academics in town who could fill an interim role should that be necessary, and that shouldn't be their number one reason for extending a contract right now.
Marta Jusen reporting. Hey, thanks, Marta.
Thank you, Tom. Have a good day.
The board of the Morial Convention Center also met this week, albeit digitally. Two big developments to report there, including a peace offering of sorts to hard-pressed hospitality workers. Michael Isaac Stein has that.
So there's kind of two interconnected issues that we've been following that were that saw developments, big developments on Thursday. The first has been a demand from a coalition of 35 local unions, advocacy groups, and other organizations who have demanded that in the wake of the coronavirus crisis, that the convention center should give up $100 million of its reserve money to give out $1,000 grants to every hospitality industry worker in the city. The other thing that we've been following is this trio of interconnected huge developments that the convention center is pursuing worth well over $1 billion. And, you know, what we've been writing about for about a month now is, given the coronavirus crisis, the economic fallout and the changed outlook for tourism for who knows how long, are these developments still prudent? And they've become connected, these two issues, because basically what the convention center says is that while it might have vast reserves, that money is really reserved or dedicated or restricted in large part to make these big developments happen. So given that background, leading into Thursday's meeting, there was some increased pressure on the convention center to donate some money. So not only do you have this coalition of 35 groups, but that group actually got backing from a huge national union called Communications Workers of America. It is one of the country's largest unions. It also happens to have a convention scheduled in New Orleans for August 2021. They sent a letter to the convention center last week threatening to pull that convention if the convention center didn't sit down with the local groups and unions and come to and negotiate with them and come to an agreement. So that brings us to Thursday. So a couple things happened on Thursday. The big one being that the convention center ended up donating $1 million to two hospitality industry aid funds. So one is run by United Way. The other is run by the Greater New Orleans Foundation. Now, $1 million is obviously sizable, but it didn't come close to satiating the coalition. They called it insufficient. And I think the big thing for them was that it didn't actually include any negotiation or consultation with these groups. It seems, you know, in their eyes to be, you know, a small part of what they asked for to kind of put the issue to bed. But, you know, the coalition is still going, still demanding $100 million. And so they'll continue to push in that direction. But the other thing that happened at Thursday's meeting is that we got some clarification on where we stand with those three big developments. And so when we talk about that, we're talking about three things. We're talking about a five-year, $557 million plan to upgrade to mainly upgrade the current convention center building. The second one is a new hotel that they want to build on the upriver side of the convention center. And the third is a so-called entertainment district that would basically surround that hotel with restaurants, bars, venues, residential housing, you know, a real massive kind of development.
Right. And certainly a lot of questions about the demand for such a massive development project towards entertainment and tourism, you know, for some times ahead that are foggy at best.
Right. And there were financial concerns, concerns about whether this was the best use of public money well before this started. But I think that attitudes started to shift, you know, like you're saying. I mean, we have no idea if hotels, the existing hotels, are going to be able to fill up next year, you know, so a lot of question marks. And so basically what we were told at Thursday's meeting, let's just go through the developments one by one. The biggest new piece of news yesterday is that on the hotel deal, the convention center has halted all negotiations with their chosen development group. So they've been negotiating with this team for a while now. They selected them last year. So it was just up to kind of these behind the scenes negotiations now. But the new chairman of the board, Walt Leger, has said that those negotiations have now been put on hold. So have plans on the entertainment district. So where that stands right now is that the convention center has three proposals that they're going to choose from to choose a development team for the entertainment district. But Walt Leger said that's going to be delayed until the convention center can have normal meetings again. Right now, all their meetings are held virtually, and he was saying that, you know, we should be able to get into a room and talk about this again and present this to the public before we make any decisions. The last one would be the $557 million capital plan. Unlike the other two, that one actually seems to be on track. On Thursday, they approved a contract for a master developer, a $5.4 million contract for a master architect, for the convention center's, you know, 5-year capital plan. So where we stand now, two of those big developments are on hold. One of them seems to be going forward, and the convention center has donated $1 million, while groups still insist that they should pay $100 million. So that's kind of the wrap on the week.
And ladies and gentlemen, no one's covering the convention center developments like Michael Isaacstein here. He's been outstanding on this beat throughout. Michael, thank you so much for taking some time to bring us up to date.
Thank you, Tom.
In criminal justice news, an inmate at the Louisiana Correctional Institute for Women in St. Gabriel has died from COVID-19. It is the third death reported of a state prisoner related to this pandemic. That women's facility now has the most confirmed cases of coronavirus of any state correctional facility in Louisiana. 55 prisoners there have tested positive. And there's growing concern about cases at the jail in New Orleans. Nick Crastle reports.
The sheriff's office last week announced that they were going to implement a big push in testing. They're going to actually try and test every prisoner and staff member at the jail. So that started last week, and just this week, some of those results have been coming back in. So last Friday, there were 24 total confirmed cases of coronavirus at the jail. Some of those prisoners had been released. And today, as of the latest update, there are now 103 total positive tests for coronavirus. 21 of those inmates were released, so the sheriff's office is now has 82 positive cases of those people who are still in custody. Presumably, the sheriff's office has not been totally transparent about where those inmates are being released to, whether they're in the hospital or whether they're being released to home confinement. It's not entirely clear.
Okay. So 103 cases, Nick, is that right? 103?
Yeah, 103.
Okay. All right. Out of how many tests so far as of the sheriff's office last report?
The last report, they've tested 389 inmates. 271 of those have tested negative, and 15 of those are still pending.
Okay.
So a pretty significant percentage of the total number of tests have come back positive.
Right.
Which suggests...
Sure. I'm sorry to step on you. I was just going to say, out of a prisoner population, currently over 800 inmates?
There are right around 800 okay. Prisoners in OJC in the New Orleans jail, and sorry, I should say there are around 800 inmates in custody of the sheriff's office, but some of those are being held in a state facility at Elaine Hunt, So it's really, slightly fewer than 800 are being held in jail currently.
Okay. Is there any more talk about moving any of the detainees here in Orleans Parish to the state penitentiary at Angola?
Yeah, some parishes are doing that. The last I've heard from the sheriff's office is that they are not currently considering that, that they have room at the New Orleans jail to sufficiently segregate detainees who have tested positive from those who have not or who have not been exposed. So right now they're not considering it. The spokesperson I talked to did leave the option open. He said that if, circumstances changed, they might reevaluate that option. But he didn't give any specifics about when that might happen or what the scenario would be in which they might look at that option.
Copy that. Nick Krastel reporting on the Criminal Justice Beat. Nick, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
There's growing concern that contact tracing will be critical in fighting COVID-19 while eventually getting the state's economy running again. How to accomplish that is not quite as clear. Leslie Carday has that and more in health news.
It's very difficult without a sophisticated method of collecting information, which would be, and this is something that Apple and Google are working on and have completed right now, which is an app that you can put on your phone, which I think it comes on board in May, which will tell you anytime you're 6 feet or less away from somebody for more than 15 minutes, it pings your phone and starts giving you a geographical list of where you've been. Okay, now, let's say you're in a grocery store, Tom, and you get an email alert that says, on May 15th, Joe Blow, they won't give you the name, but they'll say an infected person was walking through the store. Were you in the store at this time? Because now you say to yourself, okay, I was in the store at noon on May 15th, and I was exposed to somebody with an active virus walking around. Let me go get tested. You may not have symptoms at that point, but you may already be pre-symptomatic and be shedding virus and contaminating other people. So this gives us a good idea. Now, as one of my epidemiologists pointed out, it becomes really difficult if you're on a New York subway, which we don't have happening yet. But if we all start going back to our normal lives, your phone's going to be pinging like crazy because you will have been around people for more than 15 minutes at less than 6 feet away. But wouldn't you want to know if you've been exposed? Because that's the big common denominator right now that none of us is aware of. I don't know that when I walk into a grocery store or a drugstore that I'm not standing as somebody brushes by me in an aisle next to someone who is perhaps with the virus and potentially can infect me. So I would want to know those things. And especially when you're around family members, you might find that one of them has come out to a grocery store, come back with a virus, and now you at least know that they're shedding virus and you go immediately get a test. And that's why it's so important to have these tests out there that we can readily get to. I want a test that tells me, do I have it now, or more likely 20% of the population they think has already been infected and a large percentage of them never even knew they had the virus. That's important. So contact tracing means we've got to figure out where you're around, who you've been exposed to, and who you've exposed, Tom. And then we go from there and we get an immediate test that takes 5 minutes and tells us, yay or nay, you're infected or not, or you've been infected and now have antibodies. All that's important.
Leslie, is contact tracing something that has been performed successfully in some other countries? South Korea comes to mind.
Yeah, South Korea has done a great job of this, but that's because, first of all, they start with a base that we don't have, which is we've done approximately 1% of the population in terms of testing. They've done between 5 and 10% of their population. So they have a much bigger database to begin with. They know who's been infected much more so than we do. And they have gone out from those people and said, who have you been around? Now, they haven't taken it to the degree that they put apps on their phone because that's a brand new concept. And, you know, we have drones now that can do this. They just showed them a couple of days ago. We have drones that can go up, hover over cities, and based on heat, they can tell if each individual is at a high temperature and has a fever. I mean, I know this sounds like 1984. I realize this is all rather draconian, but the point is we have the potential to really find those people out there who are infected. Now, obviously, in the case of this app, this has to be an opt-in thing. I have to want to do this. But I don't understand why you wouldn't want to know if you've been around somebody who's been infected. I don't consider that an invasion of my privacy, certainly, because it goes on my phone and tells me where I've been. So I think it's a great thing. And I think as time goes on and people want to get back to work, which they already do, this is our entree into doing such a thing.
I know you'll keep an eye out for developments on that front in the days and weeks to come. Another story you've been following this week is the topic of medical waste, of which certainly our community is generating a lot of it right now.
Well, you know, I was turned on to this story by a friend of mine who's an infectious disease specialist, and she said to me, you know, this is something that most people don't even think about, but we're generating an enormous amount of medical waste. And when I actually started looking into it, I realized that this has been a big problem in Asia already. They had to build whole treatment facilities to take care of disinfecting all of this medical waste. So here's what happens. Each one of the major entities in terms of hospitals has a company that comes around and picks up all their medical waste. Now, the question is, what do you do with that medical waste? Well, the coronavirus specifically is not considered toxic or radioactive, so it falls into the broad base of 85% of medical waste. But you still have to autoclave this stuff, which means at temperatures exceeding 300 degrees and at 50 pounds per square inch of pressure, and that gets rid of it, and then it's taken to a landfill. But think about what we are generating on a daily basis that we never saw before in terms of contaminated masks and gloves and gowns and booties and all the rest of this stuff, including needles. It has to go someplace. I mean, so medical waste has become a big problem. And as you said, not just in hospitals, it's a problem on the street. I was talking to Sydney Torres, who owns a garbage collection company, and he was saying that, yeah, you think it's a problem with masks and gloves that you see in parking lots, which is already very disturbing, and which Fauci has commented on and said, how can you do this? How can you take something off your hands and off your face and throw it in a parking lot? It's contaminated, perhaps. And now somebody has to come along and pick it up. Well, now we've got garbage workers, sanitation people, who are coming around in open air trucks. People don't listen. They're supposed to have their garbage in bags and tied up. But many times they dump a garbage can and trash is flying. So the garbage collection people then have to go on the street, pick it up and put it in the truck. A lot of what they're finding now is people who are self-quarantined and wearing masks in their own homes. And now they're part of the general garbage collection. The difference is those are not autoclaves because they're not considered part of the medical waste problem. That's a biological thing that's marked and tagged and goes into an autoclave. So we've got a lot of contamination throughout the city just with masks and gloves that are all over the place and aren't being contended with as medical waste is. So those are all things that are kind of eye-opening that I never thought about personally until I saw the first glove in the ground and thought, do I pick that up? No, I don't think so, because I don't know what's on it. So yeah, medical waste has become a huge problem here. We're having to increase trucks like eightfold to pick up all of the excessive medical waste that we're generating.
Right. And it's, 15%, if I recall your reporting correctly, 15% of this waste is incinerated at this point, generally speaking?
Yes, because the World Health Organization has come on and said that only 15% of what they see as medical waste, which falls into that radioactive toxic category, like you would see in Superfund dumped waste sites, only that needs to be incinerated. And let's not forget that hospitals used to do their own incineration, but the EPA came along in 1997 and said, no more of that. I mean, you're creating enormous problems with our air quality. We want this contained someplace on specific sites, not all throughout cities in incinerators that are based in hospitals. So we haven't seen that for a while. So it needs to be picked up and dealt with safely. And that's why we have medical waste companies now dealing with all of this.
A lot of factors to contend with in this slow motion disaster, if you will. And Leslie, we certainly appreciate you keeping an eye on these developments for The Lens. Leslie Carde, reporting for The Lens. Leslie, thanks as always.
Always my pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
After the break, a call for immigrant releases and WWOZ's Jazz Festing in Place is underway. We'll hear about it. I'm Tom Wright with Behind the Lens.
Hi, I'm Harry Shearer. You're hearing it from everyone these days, stay home and stay safe. Well, I'd like to wind the calendar back just about 14 years. Here in New Orleans, we had a challenge that was truly existential. We were not only gutting our houses down to the studs, we were gutting our lives, if we still had them, down to the studs. We've rebuilt New Orleans one home, one store, one restaurant at a time. We did it. What we're asked to do now is child's play by comparison. We're gutting our social lives down to the studs temporarily. As in the days after the flood, we're depending on each other to keep the city and ourselves afloat. But for most of us, all we really need to do to slow down and eventually stop this pandemic is simply stay home and stay safe. There's plenty of time to gather, work, parade, and party when this thing is over. The more we self-isolate now, the sooner that day will come. Thanks.
I'm Karen Gadbois, founder and director at The Lens. We're committed to covering the COVID-19 crisis here in South Louisiana. The business of journalism is important and crucial, and all our staff is working hard to bring you accurate and vital reporting. But we can't do this work without your continued support for nonprofit news. Learn about ways you can help us keep the lights on at our website, thelensnola.org/donate. And remember, stay home, stay informed. We thank you.
You're listening to Behind the Lens on podcast app, on our website, or on one of our partner radio stations, 90.3 FM WAMFLP and 102.3 FM WHIV LP New Orleans. We're not sure how many immigrants are being detained at the six federal facilities in Louisiana, but we know there are thousands of them. And some legal advocates are demanding the release of the most vulnerable migrants. Aya Saeed is an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. That group filed an emergency petition on behalf of those detainees. She spoke with Madeline Arufo for The Lens.
So how did you or your organization first hear about this potential case?
So as soon as the pandemic sort of started, we realized very early on that this was something that was going to be reaching folks behind bars in all criminal justice contexts, both from our own representation of folks in Pelican Bay to immigration detention centers. And we were then approached by colleagues of ours from the National Immigration Project of the National Lawyers Guild with facts about this case, and almost immediately hopped on the case with our partners on the ground and brought some of our own immigration detention expertise to the case.
Who are these plaintiffs generally, and why do their situations make release from confinement so imminently necessary?
The plaintiffs, 17 individuals that were detained and held, were being held in, I believe, five or six detention centers across Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. All of them, whether it's because of their age or because of their pre-existing medical conditions, were particularly vulnerable to serious illness or possibly even death if they were infected by COVID-19. And so we felt that it was virtually impossible once COVID entered the facility that some of these clients would be protected, in part because it's virtually impossible to actually enforce social distancing in order to protect our clients in these conditions. And so we started very quickly talking to folks who were in detention centers who, like our clients, presented serious pre-existing medical conditions, and or talking to other clients who are over the age, I believe, of 60, if I'm not mistaken, and sort of found our clients that way.
I would like to ask you some questions just about the conditions within these detainment facilities. To your knowledge, is it possible for anyone that's in these facilities to practice social distancing at all?
No, not at all. So they eat, sleep, and otherwise sort of commingle one another in very tight proximity. You know, one small example is when they're getting food. Everyone lines up in a single file line, no form of social distancing. Everyone sits at the same table. Even beds in some of these facilities are bunk beds. So you're literally about a few feet away from the folks sitting on top or below you. Showers, there are about four showers for, on average, maybe 50 to 60 women in some of these facilities. So in addition to the proximity, then there's also the fact that the sort of sanitary conditions in some of these facilities is fairly poor, if not completely insufficient. And so the sort of compounding of both of those factors, I think, makes it virtually impossible for folks to adequately be protected from COVID-19 if and when it enters these detention centers.
Mm-hmm. Do they have access to hygiene products such as soap or hand sanitizer?
Yes. So I believe it depends. So again, we're talking about various facilities. And the sort of particularities really differ depending on which facility we're talking about. But by and large, folks are given soap, I believe, on average of once a month, soap and other toiletries. Cleaning then, though, is sort of dependent on the detainees themselves. So they have voluntary and involuntary programs in which the sort of detainees clean out the bathrooms and the rooms. They're given soap to do as such, but they are not given clean rags every single time. Oftentimes bleach is not available. So there are definitely limitations to the kind of sanitization that can happen in these facilities. And a lot of it is also sort of ad hoc, depending on how often detainees will clean a bathroom. I mean, I think generally the expectation is that folks would clean these public spaces once a day, though from our clients, we've heard that that's not enforced. And so it really does sort of depend on the particular facility.
Mm-hmm. Can the people held in these facilities speak with a doctor or other healthcare worker if they start to feel ill?
Yeah, so a majority of our clients have pre-existing conditions and so have sought medical care before and after. And yes, there is a medical staff that's available. With that said, though, there are a few trends that I think are a bit discouraging. So one, no one has been given a COVID-19 test to see whether they have it, despite there being several instances of folks presenting COVID-like symptoms. So that's one. I think two, oftentimes when folks do present with some of these symptoms, some of what we've seen both in this litigation, other litigations, is that medical facility will sort of assume that it's just allergies and will oftentimes provide Tylenol or allergy medication to deal with some of the sinus and issues or some of the other respiratory issues. When we assume not everyone has allergies at the same time, mm-hmm. there may be other things that are going on, and I don't know that folks are being taken seriously. There's also, I think, I've seen and I've heard of examples of folks who no longer want to go seek help from a doctor because there are rumors that there is COVID-19 that's spreading within these detention centers. And a lot of folks with pre-existing conditions have taken it amongst themselves to distance themselves from medical staff out of fear. Because the rumor suggests that if it were to sort of spread, it would start in the medical unit, essentially. And so those kinds of patterns, I think, are very worrisome for us. And at the end of the day, I think the problem is less so, access, though that is also a thing worth discussing. But when we're talking about a pandemic like the coronavirus, any type of exposure to it, right, before you see a doctor even, is dangerous. And so we think that the only way, and other health experts agree, I think, that the only way really to deal with this pandemic and really to get at the heart of decreasing the number of lives lost because of this pandemic is to socially distance and to therefore release as many folks behind bars as possible. And so I think that's sort of where the point of intervention of this kind of litigation focuses.
The Lens reached out to an ICE spokesperson, Brian Cox, who declined to comment specifically on this litigation, but he did make some broad statements about how ICE was handling the spread of COVID-19. And he said, quote, "Testing is being conducted at all ICE facilities in accordance with CDC guidance, and all persons are being screened upon arrival at ICE facilities." Have you found this to be the case at the facilities in which your clients are held?
So, first of all, I think according to the last time I checked, the number of people that have gotten tested by ICE in all of their facilities is no more than, I believe, 400. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about thousands upon thousands of people being held behind bars in these sorts of detention facilities. And so I am hard-pressed to believe that that number is an adequate number of folks to test. Especially given the numbers of people that are held, the number of folks that are being presented with symptoms, the number of folks that are being moved from one detention to the other. We have reports from our clients that folks are being they're sort of being moved from one detention center to the next while they're demonstrating symptoms without being tested. And so they're then exposing other folks from other detention centers of some of the same illnesses. We're getting reports that even though ICE is shutting down visitation for folks who are being detained, they're not in fact seeing each and every guard, each and every contractor, each and every nurse or medical staff that's entering the building. Moreover, we're getting reports that all of the staff, or maybe I would say a majority of the staff rather, is not wearing gloves or not wearing masks adequately throughout the facilities. Folks are not being given masks and gloves in the facilities. And so, it's really at this stage, I think, a ticking time bomb until these cases really start to ravish a lot of these detention centers. And we've already started getting calls from folks who are expressing to us and describing to us symptoms that are almost identical to COVID-19 symptoms and have gotten zero to no medical attention. So I personally am hard pressed to think that a number that low is adequate. Do think that there are some discrepancies in the official reporting and what's actually happening on the ground.
Do you have a ballpark number for how many immigrant detainees are held in federal custody in Louisiana?
I don't, but I can do some digging and get back to you on that.
So if people your organization represents were to be released, what would that process look like? Where would they go?
So actually, in our complaint, one of the things, and in our client interviews, one of the things that we were very keen on is to ask that very question. And all of our plaintiffs or clients have family members and sponsors that have agreed to sort of take care of them and continue the sponsorship application process for them. So they would be released to their family members, essentially. Helen, for example, our lead plaintiff, has a sister, a mother, and a daughter, all of whom live in Louisiana, and she was about two semesters away from finishing nursing school. And so there's already a home waiting for her and a child actually yearning for her presence. She's just one of 17 other folks who really have oftentimes robust lives outside of detention centers that they can sort of integrate back into fairly seamlessly.
Mm-hmm. So I'll ask you one more question. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
Sure.
So basically, what would you say to someone who believes that the people held in these facilities should continue to be detained because they're a risk to public safety?
A few things. One, legally, I believe the rationale that ICE gives to holding folks in these detention centers is either one of safety and also one of ensuring that folks come to and attend their immigration hearings. And a vast majority of immigrants being held in these detention centers are simply being held because ICE wants to ensure that they're going to appear at their hearing. Now, then that begs the question, is placing individuals in detention centers where they may possibly be facing death, does that trump the agency's ability to ensure that folks come to their detention hearing?
That was Aya Said with the Center for Constitutional Rights, speaking with our own Madeline Arufo. User-generated content via YouTube from the Midnight Disturbers and Trombone Shorty playing the 2011 New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival. 9 years later, Jazz Fest is once again underway, sort of. Community radio station WWOZ is broadcasting recordings of Jazz Fest in past years, making ample use of the Jazz and Heritage Foundation's archives. Now, we don't have access to those archives, but we did get a chance to speak with Beth Arroyo-Utterback. She is general manager of WWOZ. Talk first about what it takes to organize a virtual jazz fest amid a pandemic. I mean, how does the station tackle a project like that?
We were laughing about this yesterday, about organizing a virtual jazz fest, and we were doing it virtually ourselves. So we've taken it to a whole new level, not only presenting a virtual jazz fest, but those of us that are working on it are actually working on it virtually, because we only allow a few people to actually physically come into the station at one time. We're always switching off hours, so people are also working at home. So it's the first virtual jazz fest. We're breaking all kinds of records here. But the idea was, it was too good not to do it, and I really felt that people needed something to bring some joy to their lives. After the pandemic began and people had to stay at home, you know, we started to get these very long and heartfelt emails and letters from people who really were just like at home and had nothing better to do. So somebody that may have sent us, you know, whatever, a check or a membership with like a line or two about how much they like the station, all of a sudden we're getting these like letters like that are 2 pages long about all the things that OZ means to them and what's going on in their life. And a lot of the letters were very serious in tone. A lot of the letters, you know, one that I shared was, you know, I've been quarantined in my basement in Canada for 3 weeks, and I feel like I'm going crazy, and the only thing that keeps me sane is listening to WWOZ. And so we had many letters from not only locally but around the world with that kind of tone about how much WWOZ meant to these people, especially at this difficult time. And so we decided, you know, during Jazz Fest time, we're out there broadcasting Jazz Fest anyway. That's what we do. I mean, many people are aware of that. Many people were not aware of that, apparently. And so, you know, we just thought that this would make people happy and bring some joy to people at a time that they needed it. And I really did think it did, because the minute we made the announcement that we were going to be doing Jazz Fest in place and doing 8 days of Jazz Fest, the tone of all of our emails and letters changed. It went from kind of a pensive but thankful tone to almost like a joyful tone, like, oh, there's some normalcy I can hold into. One woman wrote, "Leave it to WWOZ to create a silver lining." And that really summed up, you know, hundreds and hundreds of emails. And so, you know, we know there's a lot of things going on in the world right now, a lot of very serious things, and we're certainly not medical responders, but I do think that we are cultural first responders. And since WWOZ is part of the jazz and heritage family, we think that this is the thing that we do, because this is what families do. And this is a very special jazz fest, because this is a jazz fest that could never happen in real life, because so many of the people in the cubes have passed away. So to have kind of a dream jazz fest where you can have Fats Domino playing and Dr. John playing and, you know, Ellis Marcellus and all the Neville brothers playing, I think that's a gift to the world from WWOZ and the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival and the foundation. And that's how we're doing our part.
Of course, WWOZ has been a longtime supporter, integral supporter of Jazz Fest. Explain, if you would, the cultural significance of Jazz Fest against the greater backdrop of New Orleans culture.
Well, you know, besides Mardi Gras, I think that that Jazz Fest is really an event that defines New Orleans not only for itself, but for the rest of the world. And one of the things that we say here at WWOZ is, if you can't live in New Orleans, let New Orleans live in you. And I think that Jazz Fest and OZ and the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation are all manifestations of that thought, is that there's a lot of people that will write to me. They'll say, "I'm not from New Orleans, but my heart is." People have a very special connection to New Orleans. And the thing about Jazz Fest is it brings together all the
so many of the things that makes New Orleans special. It brings together the best music that we have to offer. It brings together some of the best food and drink that we have to offer. It brings together artisans and, you know, and crafts from around the state so that people can, it's not only just a musical fest, it's about the crafts, it's about the music, it's about the food, but it's even more than that. Because with the Allison Minor stage, we also, you know, are interviewing musicians and hearing their stories or hearing about somebody that passed on and playing their music. So it's about education. It's about culture. It's about the Mardi Gras Indians who, as we like to say, you never know when they're coming around because they do what they want to.
Uh-huh.
That's on the bottom of our cubes, by the way. And so we've just decided during this time just to have as much fun as possible, encourage people to take some time out from the news, to take some time out and actually try to create Jazz Fest where they are. Create it in your backyard, create it on your front porch. If it's rainy outside, create it on the floor in your living room and have your own moment of Jazz Fest. That's what we're looking for. That's all that, like that, that is our message to the world is that, you know, worrying, you take a break from worrying. We all have time to worry. We've all been worried, but take a break from worrying and make Jazz Fest at your home. And I'm going to tell you where I got that idea about Jazz Fest in place. My mom and dad were longtime Jazz Festers, like from the earliest Jazz Festers. I can't say for sure they went to the very first one, but if they didn't, they were at the second one. And they were, you know, diehard Jazz Festers. And as they got older in the late 90s, they're no longer with us. And they had this idea, and I'm sure other people have had this idea too all around the world, is that, you know what, if I can't go to Jazz Fest, I'm going to bring Jazz Fest to me. So they had a carport that they would decorate with their different flags that they used to bring to Jazz Fest. My mom would cook a different dish every day, like red beans and rice or jambalaya or yak mein. And my dad had the outside refrigerator, because every good New Orleanian has an outside refrigerator outside of their, you know, in their carport. And yeah, he had his stock with beers, waters, and all the soft drinks that all of us kids and everybody in the neighborhood liked. And they had two speakers set up where they would, you know, play the music that WWOZ was playing the whole time of Jazz Fest. And they were like, you know, my dad always called it Jazz Fest with my own private bathroom.
Yeah.
So he set up his own Jazz Fest, and it was really out of necessity because they just physically couldn't do it anymore. It was just too hard, too many long hours, and then they just decided they'd rather do it this way. So, you know, they proved a long time ago that it's a state of mind. And even though, you know, you're not going to have every single thing that you had, it's a way to have a taste of Jazz Fest. And you, if it's in your mind and your heart, you can have Jazz Fest.
Yeah.
Another reason that we're doing it is to connect people locally. Now, we know this isn't going to help people nationally. We're going to be providing recipes for some favorite Jazz Fest cuisine, dishes, drinks. But locally, any of our vendors, any of the Jazz Fest vendors who are, you know, currently making and selling products, you know, we are making a concerted effort to connect our followers on Facebook and our social media to them, so that you can have, you know, if you're local, you can drive up and get Miss Linda's yak mein or, you know, Crawfish Monica. So like you would from the Jazz Fest. But, you know, we have to keep in mind that we have listeners not only from the country but all over the world, so they don't have that luxury. So we're going to send them recipes so that they can as best approximate that as they can.
While you were talking there, Beth, I couldn't help but think to myself of the power of and immediacy of digital media in terms of just giving people something to do with their time as so many of us are really stuck at home, but also that great synergy between new media, you know, live streaming, and the sort of archival riches that WWOZ has access to be able to provide this to people, you know, over 2 weeks time. It's really impressive.
That's actually a great point, because I'll tell you, You know, we're not really just a radio station. We really are a multimedia platform. And we have a whole video department here. And, you know, last weekend we were celebrating French Quarter Fest with actual videos that we took from previous French Quarter Fest. So we put together our own French Quarter Fest, and people were doing like a smaller version of what we're doing with Jazz Festing. So we use, you know, not only our video team, I mean, they are all over the city constantly documenting everything. Obviously, our radio station, which is a powerful thing that we do, but we also have an extremely active Facebook and also Twitter feed as well. And we have many, many thousand, over 100,000 people that follow us on Facebook. So that's really an important connection for folks as well. So my recommendation is not only have it on WWOZ, whether it's 90.7 FM if you're in our area, or WWOZ.org, but also follow us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, follow us on Twitter if you do all those things, because we can't do everything on one medium. So, you know, you can't actually, you know, I guess you could talk about a recipe on the radio, but we're not going to do that. So that's going to be on our social media. That's going to be on our website. Yeah. So, you know, for people to have the full experience, we're hoping that they will, you know, follow our suit and just kind of like turn it up, listen to the music, and then follow us on social media to get the other parts of the festival as well. And that's really our gift to the world. I mean, you know, we aren't doctors and we're not nurses. We're not EMTs. We're not, you know, people who are transportation people. But one thing we do love and know is music and culture of New Orleans. And we know how much it means to so many people, not just locally, but nationally and internationally. And this is our gift to them. And it's the right thing to do because we are part of the Jazz Fest family. And, you know, when your family member, when they're unable to do something and you can step up and do it, I think that's what we ought to do. And that's exactly what we're doing.
As the podcast drops Friday, the Jazz Festing is underway. And Beth, we thank you so much for giving us a preview. Beth Arroyo Utterback, General Manager of WWOZ. Find more information at WWOZ.org. I also like your app, Beth, by the way.
That's right. Download the app. I forget to tell people that because I'm always listening on my radio. I'm very old school. I have to tell you all, I'm very old. If you saw my radio, you would laugh. But it works, and I get WWOZ, and that's all that matters.
Listen, any way you can. Beth, thank you so much.
Thank you, and thank you guys for the work you do. We really appreciate you all. And everybody, you know, have a good Jazz Fest and be safe out there. This is what I say, that we're bringing ourselves together but staying apart. And that's what this is all about, festing in place.
More details and live streaming at WWOZ.org. That's the podcast for this week. Our reporting is always online at thelensnola.org. We leave you this week with music by Kevin MacLeod. It's not Jazz Fest, but it's free, it's groovy, and it's yours. I'm Tom Wright. Thank you for getting Behind the Lens.